from Whispers from Eternity, prayer number 72. O divine sculptor, chisel thou my life. Every sound that I make, let it have the vibration of thy voice. Every thought that I think, let it be saturated with the consciousness of thy presence. Let every feeling that I have glow with thy love. Let every act of my will be impregnated with thy divine vitality. Let every thought, every expression, every ambition be ornamented by thee. O divine sculptor, chisel thou my life according to thy design. Om. Okay. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today for our Sunday service. Our topic today, truth invites, it never commands. I had a humorous example of this very topic just earlier this week when Asha and I were encountering a recent infestation of flies. And Asha was trying to catch some of the flies and to rid us of the infestation. And there's this odd phenomenon when trying to catch flies, if you haven't observed this yourself, when if you try and do it with your hand, it's something to do with physics and the fourth dimension, that when you move your hand, it's like it displaces enough wind that the fly manages to seemingly always escape. And I watched this happen a few times, and then after actually a number of hours, I told Asha, you know, I've heard that apparently if you, instead of trying to squash a fly with your hand, but if you clap right above them, the fly, because of its lack of higher intellect, will actually leap off of the surface that it's resting on betwixt your hands. And sure enough, I then demonstrated the technique and it worked. And then she tried it and it worked. And she said, what's been going on? Why have you been holding out on me? And I said, truth invites, it never commands. And actually on that vein, I had another very charming moment. There's a Sunday service topic in a few weeks entitled Victory Demands the Courage of Conviction. And I can't resist telling this story because I myself enjoy a little bit of courage of conviction from time to time. And I was living in an ashram in Los Angeles, and there was one of my housemates who was lacking a little bit of that firm conviction in a particular area of her life and was sort of waffling between this and that. And I told her very passionately in the kitchen, I said, victory demands the courage of conviction. And she looked at me with this dumbfounded face and said, what does that even mean? And thankfully, I had an interpreter in the room, Drupada, who, if you don't know Drupada, he's a little bit very interiorized and has a very wry sense of humor at times. And he turned and he said, I think he means stick to your guns. And yeah, that's in fact exactly what I meant. And so it is that with these Sunday service readings, with truth, we can't just bombast our way to understanding, but we have to digest them, meditate on them, and then, just like he did in that example, suddenly the truth will reveal itself effortlessly without needing to shake its fist at you. This topic, truth invites, it never commands, is an interesting one because Swami begins by talking about the essential necessity of free will in the universe. And I don't know about you, but from time to time, I often wish that there wasn't quite so much free will because I often seem to be getting myself in a whole lot of trouble, oh my Lord. As Yogananda says in the chant, desire, my great enemy, is giving me lots of trouble, oh my Lord. And it's true, he has given us lots of trouble, oh my Lord, for how many millions and millions of incarnations? And the Lord will never impose himself upon us. Yogananda said very charmingly that God has like an inferiority complex, that he will not impose himself unless he is invited. And that in this reading, Swami says that we can live in a self-created darkness for eons if we so choose, but also we can choose to live more and more in the light, that we can learn to receive that truth, like Shanti was talking about with the fire ceremony this morning, that when we begin to open our hearts and we say, I seek purification by the grace of God, then truly we do put one step forward on the long journey towards purification, towards transcendence. Because as Krishna then goes on later to explain, we have to work with our own natures. We cannot suppress ourselves in the attempt to be some version of spirituality that we think we ought to be. This is a very slippery slope, because we have an ideal that we are trying to live up to. We have the yamas and we have the niyamas. We have the examples of saints. We have the examples of the masters. We have the examples of our fellow guru bhais on the path. And we can see living examples of what it is to live a life dedicated to God. But it can be all too easy for us to therefore slip into the shoulds, thinking I should be this way, I shouldn't feel this way, I ought to already behave this way, I've been practicing Kriya for 10 years, I shouldn't feel anger anymore. Well, sometimes perhaps we do, nonetheless. And then what? Of what avail, then, is suppression? In the essence of the Bhagavad Gita, Swami Kriyananda writes a stunning statement that he says, perhaps all of human suffering is rooted in wishing that circumstances were other than they are. Of what avail, then, is suppression? What this is inspiring me to contemplate is the need, therefore, for deep, impersonal, honest introspection. Because only after we've introspected deeply and authentically can we offer that clay into the divine grace to be transformed, like that chant of Yogananda's we did at the beginning, from clay into gold, from darkness into light, from evil into good. But so long as we hold our weaknesses, so long as we hold our inadequacies behind the barriers of our own shame, of our own guilt, God's grace cannot come, because he will never impose himself upon us, as even though it may be convenient if he would. And so let us more and more fearlessly introspect, fearlessly examine ourselves, fearlessly accept our hearts for what they really are, that we may offer it into the hands of the divine to discover our own highest potential. One of my favorite things about the study of astrology, which I have now embarked upon in the last few years, or rather, perhaps it came and knocked on my door and declared that it was now time for me to begin. And in astrology, all the planets, which represent rays of God's consciousness, rays of the divine manifestation, are not absolutes, but they rather represent a gradient of consciousness. And what I mean by this is any particular ray of consciousness can be expressed at its highest point, closest to God, when it is most sattvic and uplifting and inspiring, or it can be expressed in a rajasic way, or in a tamasic, darkening, sorrowful way. And with the study of astrology, I have begun to see for my own eyes that my own qualities are not predestined, but that they are merely tendencies on a spectrum of consciousness, and that the very same quality in me that makes me fear, that makes me tremble in anxiety when I think of the future, that makes me uncertain of the decisions I've made, that makes me doubt my own worth, that is the same vibration that when I offer it into the divine light, that allows me to surrender completely into his vibration. It's the same essence. It's just manifested differently. And so we have a great incentive before us that every quality that we have within us, every lead, every weight, every clay, is in fact the ammunition you need to become the saint that you are destined to become. If you were to simply get rid of it, you would never become as great as you will surely one day be. But it is all these seeming weaknesses. It is all these seeming bundles of past bad karma that when transmuted will give us the power, will give us the grace to realize our true oneness with our Father, Mother, God. I was just reading Autobiography of a Yogi the other night, because in preparation for Sunday service, it seemed like a very thorough and good thing to do. And I was struck rereading that book. First, of Why am I not constantly reading this book? It's truly one of our great scriptures. And I was chuckling to myself because Swami Kriyananda at the end of his life was pretty forthcoming about the idea that he claimed, or I shouldn't say claimed, pretty forthcoming that he thought Master was a reincarnation of Christ. And I was sort of chuckling to myself that Christ let other people catalog his life. And maybe that didn't turn out so well. So in this incarnation, he figured, I'm going to do it myself. I'm going to write the autobiography to make sure I get everything in there I want. And so I was reading Autobiography of a Yogi with reverence, with a sacred appreciation that these are the words of a God-realized avatar who has chosen every word, who has impregnated every word with his sacred vibration to show us the way home. And I was rereading that book and I was struck so palpably by his vibration. And one other thing that a sort of tangential inspiration that occurred to me whilst reading it was, I've read that book many times. And the first time I read it, it was like, you know, a spiritual high adventure novel of a young man meeting saints, going on adventures, having cosmic consciousness, meeting his guru, traveling to America. It was all very fun and good. But the more I read it and the more I mature on the spiritual path, the more I think I'm beginning to see the depth of the diamond that he has left for us in that book. And the other night when I was reading it, I had a new revelation that when Yogananda writes, we ought to consider how he uses the pronoun I. As Asha has often referenced in relationship to the Bible, when Christ says I, he's not always referring to Christ, this body. He's referring to the Christ consciousness. He's referring to God, the infinite, who has taken manifested form on our behalf. And just reading the book, suddenly with that feeling in mind, I was struck when his sister Roma asks him to intercede on behalf of her husband, who is a doubter and who constantly is harassing her for believing in saints. And Yogananda says, I will help you. And that's the voice of God answering her prayer in living form. How beautiful. So I was struck by that the autobiography of a yogi is in itself a perfect invitation to truth. That Yogananda, through that writing, is constantly inviting us to achieve a different state of consciousness, to live in a new way, to live with greater devotion, with greater aspiration, with deeper attunement to him and to this great line of gurus. He doesn't command it. He just invites you by showing the fruit of a life given to God in all of its wonders. But I was also struck, the autobiography is just a miraculous book. And whenever I need something, I think I'm learning now. I'm a slow learner. At times, I've had questions, you know, deep imponderables. And I've thought, I wish I could just ask Master this question. And in a flash of perhaps divine insight, I thought, well, let's just ask Master. So I prayed with the autobiography and I said, Master, teach me the secret of this question. And I opened the page randomly and lo, where I first cast my eye, he described exactly what I was wondering about. It's very helpful. And so the other night when I opened autobiography to begin my preparation for today, I thought, Master, please help me. Give me the right material for my Sunday service talk in a few days. Boop! And I opened up the book to the chapter on Luther Burbank. And I'll admit, as embarrassing as it is, I thought, the Luther Burbank chapter? Please, can we do another one? Because that's the one of the chapters that I might have skipped if I had been, you know, speed reading it. Because you know, horticulture and flowers and, you know, grafting trees doesn't exactly interest my normal personality, but I thought, no, let's have a sense of faith. Let's have a sense of spiritual adventurousness, and let's read this chapter with fresh eyes and with a sense of receptivity, with a sense of deep listening. And so I did. And I read that chapter on Luther Burbank, the American saint to whom Yogananda dedicated the entire book. High praise. And I read that chapter, and it was so beautiful. It was so inspiring. It was so uplifting. But what struck me so poignantly was Burbank talked about in his practice of grafting fruit that he discovered that plants have a tremendous will. And bear with me, this will come into focus in a second. He said that a plant perhaps has developed a certain set habit over the course of millions of years, perhaps. He said, tracing its way back to when it was first clawing life out of the very rocks. And he said, surely that plant develops a tenacity of will that no human can match. But when you graft that plant with another harmonious and sattvic influence, suddenly that negative influence is stopped immediately and can redirect its energy in a positive direction. And I thought, oh my gosh, we are that naughty plant. For how many millions of years have we wandered in our self-imposed darkness, deaf to the cries of God inviting us to live in a higher way? And like that plant, we have developed a tremendous tenacity of will towards wrong action. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, or Arjuna says, what is it that drives men as if against their will towards destruction? And Krishna says, it is desire, man's greatest foe. We have become so habituated in chasing happiness through our desires and through the senses in the world that we have become like that little plant. We've become trained, battle-hardened over millions of incarnations, entrenched in negative habits, that if we were to simply pick away at them one generation at a time, we would never succeed. Like trying to breed a new potato just by picking the best one every time. But what Burbank discovered is when you graft that reluctant plant with a positive one, then immediately it's off to a new life. And so too with us, I thought, we can graft our negative habits to positive qualities of God aspiration, that by opening to receive His grace, we can transform our destiny instantaneously to the degree to which we sincerely open ourselves to receive His grafting power of grace. And this dovetails back into what I was saying a moment ago about astrology, that the same planet that may cause me to be anxious and endlessly worry may in time, by the grace of God, give me the profound ability to be so supremely detached from this world that I will die freely, perhaps. That would be its highest manifestation, and I pray that it is so. And so for each of us, ask of yourself, what qualities do I have yet within my heart that hold me back? What qualities do I have that cause me to suffer? And how can I offer them more sincerely to God? Because, yes, heroism is needed. Energy is needed. Courage is needed, as we will talk about in the future Sunday service. But grace, too, is needed. And God's grace can only enter when we sincerely open our hearts to receive, when we sincerely offer ourselves without any boundaries, without any egotistical pride, but like a child crying for help. I once was in Los Angeles a number of years ago, and I was going through a very challenging period of my life. And I don't know that it was necessarily medical, but I was struggling with some feelings of depression. Just there was an unmovable weight, a heaviness that rested on my shoulders, and a deep-seated sorrow and grief and fear and anxiety and self-criticism that hounded me, dogged me night and day, and that it drove me to wrong behavior in search of solace until it just wound me up into a tighter and tighter wheel of self-flagellation and misery. And I realized that I had a very strong ego attachment to overcoming it myself. This is very deadly. Here I was being crushed flat by the weight of some karma, and I didn't want to cry for help because I wanted to prove to Master that I could do it myself. In my mind, I wanted to come to Him as a conquering hero saying, "Lo, I have defeated this enemy. Aren't you proud of me?" But the more I clung to that desire, the more it ground me into oblivion. Until finally one day, it ground me low enough, and I literally collapsed on my floor, and I wept uncontrollably, sincerely, deeply, without any reservation. I wept And I begged God to take the pain away because I couldn't cope with it anymore. It was too big for me. I was helpless, like a dog surrendering itself to its master, like a defeated soldier throwing up its arms. I said, "Master, I can't do it alone." And from that moment, my life began to change. In that moment, the pride of my heart cracked, and Master's grace could come in. And day by day, meditation by meditation, prayer by prayer, that light within me began to grow until I could feel His grace expanding, devouring the darkness, until vitality began to flow through me again. And then inspiration began coming unbidden to my mind. Creative thoughts, inspiration, motivation, understanding of truth. Suddenly this light began to burn within me, devouring the darkness. And one series of revelation led to the next, and a positive momentum was born in that moment. And that's what led me in part to energizing 6 times a day. I was practicing Mahamudra 20 minutes a day. I was meditating 3-4 hours a day. It was a very specific moment of karma in my life. I'm not saying that everyone has the time to do that, God forbid. I mean, it took me 5 hours alone just to complete. But that power transformed me. But it was not my own power. All of those techniques, all of the techniques that we have on the spiritual path are for one purpose alone, and that is to open our heart more deeply to that transformative power of grace. And someone asked me after I had gone through this transformation, they said, "You never seem to get upset anymore." And I said, "Oh, I guess you're right, I don't." And they said, "How do you do that?" And I said, "Because I've decided that I will no longer allow my own limitations to define who I am. I am the disciple of a great master, and he will never abandon me. And I will never abandon him, because as St. Peter said, where else would I go? God is infinite. Our guru is infinite. He already knows our weaknesses. He already knows our faults, our flaws, our failings. And he is waiting to transform them." Yogananda said that he sees all of us as beings of light. If only we could see ourselves in that same way. I once said to a friend, and I said it very sincerely, they were doubting themselves and going through a hard time, and I said to them, "If only you could see yourself through my eyes, you would never doubt yourself again. But imagine if we could see ourselves through God's eyes. Truly, we would never doubt ourselves again. We would never doubt grace again. We would never doubt life again. Because we would see." And that was the affirmation for this week, wisdom. What is wisdom but to see truth? But to understand reality for what it really is and to perceive our unity with it. Truth is one and eternal. Realize your oneness with it in your deathless self within. God bless you, my friends.